I'll invite you to go with me now to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, where we have been these last few weeks. Our text for the day will be verses 18 through 25. We're going to go back to verse 14 in order to get context. Because we start kind of right in the middle of a thought, it's helpful for us to see where we've come from. Let's pick up with verse 14. Paul says, I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one may say that you were baptized in my name. I did baptize also the household of Stephanas. Beyond that, I do not know whether I baptized anyone else. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. Then our focus for the day, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. To us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since, in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and folly to the Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. This is the word of the Lord. What on earth do you say to Corinth? If you're Paul, you've got to make contact with Paul with Corinth. What on earth do you say to a church that is so broken, so disordered, so fleshly? I suspect the apostle must have at some point just thought, where on earth do I start? I think you might be inclined just to say, just knock it off. Quit it. There will be a place in this book for direct confrontations and for strong calls to repentance. So there is a place for this exhortation to knock it off. But Paul knew where to start. Where do we start? Well, this was not their first message. What do we have for the church at Corinth? It is the same message that has been preached to broken people in every age. And it is the same message for us today. The message of the cross. It's occupied our praise today. Can we just acknowledge going in, we are in a theme that is inexhaustible. This is larger than any of us. We're going to celebrate it, and we're going to do everything we can to revel in this theme. But we are in a theme that is much larger than any of us. The Corinthian need and our need is the gospel, for the seeds of every Corinthian transgression are present in every heart, including ours. So we need this. We may not be as open and aggressive and as belligerent as the Corinthian church, but we understand tribalism and we understand division. We may not be suing our brothers and sisters, but the selfishness that landed them in the courts is present in us. We may not indulge lust in the same ways that they did, but that sin is present and it is dangerous. So we need today the message of the cross. That is our theme, not only for this day, but it is our theme every day. In the cross, we see the love of God most fully. In the cross, we see His holiness most fully. In the cross, we see our depravity most fully. But here, today, in this text, we're going to see the wisdom of God displayed in the cross. And in this text, we will see the power of God displayed in the cross. That will be our focus today. If it helps you to take notes, I invite you to do that. But you may want to just put your pen down and let us just let this theme wash over us today. We're just going to walk through the text celebrating the wisdom and the power of God displayed in the cross. Maybe for us, because the language of the cross is so familiar, so integral to the part of our Christian vocabulary, it may be that we have distanced ourselves from exactly what was occurring at the cross. We see crosses everywhere. There are likely crosses within sight of you right now. Ornamental crosses that dominate church architecture, that show up on clothing and jewelry, been featured in millions and millions of tattoos and imagery all over, pictures of the cross. When we consider the cross, we have the benefit of 2,000 years of church history, and it has become really iconic and central to our understanding of the Christian faith. But Paul ministered in Corinth, roughly a half century after Jesus' death on the cross, and it had yet to become ornamental in that day. The cross, the Corinthian mind, was revolting and horrific. The cross in that day remained a very grim occurrence that was wrenching in its horror and in its brutality. You probably know that a Roman citizen was exempted from this kind of execution because it was seen as too horrible. It was a means of execution for barbarians and for slaves and for foreigners. So it is hard for us to really overstate how to the natural mind, how very foolish and how peculiar the message of the cross must have landed on Corinthian ears. Paul states it plainly. For the word or the message or the preaching of the cross is just folly to those who are perishing. The word "for" at the beginning of verse 18, obviously, the next sequence of thought is linking it to the previous thought, verse 17, where we left off last week, which was this. Paul saying, I did not rely on eloquence. When I spoke to you, I did not use human wisdom. He was a very bright man, very brilliant, educated man. Some believe he would have had the equivalent of two PhDs. He was a bright, bright intellect. But he said, that is not what I braced against when I gave you the message of the gospel. I did not rely on eloquence. And the reason I didn't is because I thought it would undermine the power of the cross so that your confidence would rest in me rather than the message of the cross. So Paul is expanding on this and effectively saying this, you don't want to hide behind me. Neither do you want to hide behind Cephas or Apollos or any of the others that were mentioned, you apart from Christ. You don't want to hide behind these personalities. This is no place to rest your confidence. All other ground is sinking sand. So he's saying, this is the reason I did not use eloquence when I preached to you. I just preached a simple message of the cross. So that your confidence would not rest the wisdom of men. Paul is here pressing on what is a soft spot in the Corinthian mind. He's highlighting, I think, what may have been an idolatrous affection in their life, their love for wisdom. They loved power or influence, and they loved, deified, idolized wisdom. And I think that's why we're going to see these themes, power and wisdom, and their antonyms, that is weakness and folly. We're going to see those words surfacing over and over again, about 20 times actually, between verses 18 and the end of chapter 2. And when we speak of wisdom, we tend to think of sound thinking that leads to a fruitful and ethical life. When you speak of a wise woman or a wise man, that's probably where your mind goes. But in Corinth, they spoke of wisdom. They were talking about the intellectual firepower, the intellectual muscle can be used to bolster your place and your influence and your power and place in a community. So the most honored people in Corinth, not all that unlike our day, the most honored people in Corinth were the ones considered to be wise and powerful. In fact, if the most noteworthy figures in Corinthian history were either the philosophers or the gladiators. In that day, it might have been the Epicureans or the Stoics or the Sophists or the Platonists. And the powerful ones who started as slaves and became very wealthy would have been the gladiators. If you kept winning, you got more and more and more esteem. Remember, Matt told us that they existed on an isthmus, a landmass that was used for ships to go across, and they had what was called the Isthmus Games, and so they were elevating and obsessing over achievement. They were shameless and self-serving and status-seeking. We might just pause here and say, that is not at all unfamiliar to us. We applaud achievement. We esteem achievement. I think most of us, maybe I'm alone in this way, I'll be a little confessional. I find myself when I'm in conversation, particularly when I'm intimidated in a conversation, I'm around 4, 5, 6 different people, and you kind of realize, where am I in the strata here? If there's 6, 7 people here. There's this guy who's clearly the brightest intellect, and you know this guy's probably not the brightest intellect. You know, maybe we're somewhere right in the middle of the pack there, just kind of keeping a scoreboard above our head. Where do I fit in the pecking order? So I think this idea of status seeking associated with wisdom, influence, and power is not unique to Corinth. Well, here we have Paul right in the middle of this wisdom-obsessed culture, this assembly of wise teachers, and we'll put that in quotation marks. Here stands Paul. And his message is deliberately simple. One might conclude from the flow of this text that Paul has a problem with talk, but that is not what he is saying here. He said, I did not want you to rest in the words of wisdom. The contrast is suggested between the words of wisdom in verse 17 and the singular word of the cross in verse 18. You see the contrast there. We carry a word, a singular word, the word of the cross. And I will say that message, against the philosophical background of the Greek world, was just plain weird. It was odd. It was foolish. To these thinkers, these people who, not only the thinkers, but the people who were aligned under the thinkers, those who were allegiant to particular thinkers, I mean, they looked at this and they would say, so Paul, you're saying that the Messiah, the promised victor, ends his days suspended on a cross. That's nonsense. Okay, that is, to our minds, foolish. In fact, our text says, to the perishing, those who are dying, it is folly. But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. Now let's try to unpack that just a little bit. When we speak of power, it's probably best not to think of explosive power or mechanical power. It may be helpful to kind of associate the word effectiveness. So we sang, the last song we sang, the power of the cross. What are we speaking of there? We're speaking of the power to affect change, the effectiveness of the cross. To the perishing, this is a nonsensical message. But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. And it may be that you kind of pull back a little bit of that language, being saved. We are accustomed to saying we are saved, past tense, and that is an actual truth. But you know that Paul was very comfortable speaking of our salvation in every tense. So he would say we were saved, yes. We are justified, that is, love the big word, punctiliar. It is at a point in time. But we are being saved, and we will ultimately be saved. Thistleton, I thought, illustrated this really well by referring to people being rescued from a sinking ship, having boarded a lifeboat. You get that picture? Having been rescued from the ship, they are delivered, past tense, from peril. In the lifeboat, fleeing the wreckage, they are being saved. And when they land on the shore, they are constantly saved, fully saved. So, saved, being saved, fully saved. So he said, those who are being saved, it is the power of God. Going further into verse 14 or verse 19, he says this, I will, he said, destroy the wisdom of the wise and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. So what they are inclined to call foolishness, God will, in expression of his supremacy, destroy. One of the things we love about Paul is that he will not allow us to forget the Old Testament origins of our faith. He just always, seems like very consistently, will point back to some Old Testament prophetic reference. So here he takes us to Isaiah, where Isaiah speaks very mockingly, really, of, or God speaking through Isaiah, of the Assyrians, where they will see the king in his beauty and ask the questions, where are these competing gods? Where are they? You see that so often in Isaiah, the lunacy, the ridiculous nature of idolatry. So in Isaiah 29, verse 14, therefore I will again do wonderful things with this people and wonder upon wonder, and the wisdom of their wise men will perish. And the discernment of their discerning men will be hidden. So what is he saying here? Something is going to be destroyed. Something is going to be thwarted. What? The wisdom of the wise, the discernment of the discerning. It seems as if Paul is here correcting an error of those who might feel pressured to blend the wisdom of the Athenians with the message of the cross. I mean, we don't want to look dumb. We don't want to look foolish. So maybe if we could come up with a kind of amalgam that would allow us to retain a little respectability, but at the same time remain loyal to the message of the cross. And Paul is leaving little room for that. I mean, there is a contrast here. Wisdom of the wise, discernment of the discerning, completely destroyed. But God is pleased to save those who are being saved through the foolishness of what we preach. This was still a problem in the second century when Tertullian, who was a church leader in the African church in Carthage, asked the question, what has Jerusalem to do with Athens? That idea that somehow we're going to be able to mesh these together in a way that satisfies everybody. The truth is, pluralism is not a modern phenomenon. It's as old as Corinth. I think we see it. I think we've all been kind of Oprah-fied, haven't we? And we just see that, this kind of a respect for, or, you know, kind of a expressing the validity of different belief systems. Pluralism teaches us that we have to acknowledge the validity of philosophies and religious systems. And while we don't have to necessarily adopt their thinking, we have to kind of peacefully recognize their strengths and their heritage and allow room for dissent. When you look at a passage like this, and we have to be plain with the text, from the broad, big picture, these philosophies are not just weak alternatives, they are rebel ideologies that must be destroyed and will be in time destroyed. And these kind of ideas, all the varying, this runs completely counter to the pressure that we get from the culture to recognize as valid any kind of belief system. I was talking to Kirk the other night, and he was just talking about a particular religion. He'd heard some about and read some about the Church of Scientology and some of the really strange, odd beliefs that they hold to. And you could just go right down the list of the various religions, and we acknowledge and we recognize they are in bondage, and we must preach a gospel that frees. But all of these various belief systems that we would point to that they would describe as a worldview, yet we would recognize as a rebel ideology that will, by the cross, be destroyed. So in verse 19, the wisdom of the wise is a thing to be destroyed, and the discernment of the discerning is a thing to be thwarted, and the means that God will employ to subdue the wisdom of the wise is the cross. The simple message of the cross. It is just that preposterous message that destroys the wisdom of the wise and thwarts the discernment of the discerning. So Paul sort of here steps to the platform in a place that was obsessed with wisdom. And he just speaks up in verse 20 and says, who is the one who is wise? Where is he? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? This series of questions, verse 20, could be an invitation to debate. Some have seen that there. More likely, it is kind of consistent with the proper kind of sarcasm that is used in the book of Isaiah. Where are they? These are your gods. This is your system of thought. Where are these people? Probably three categories of wise ones. Where are the one who is wise? Probably the Greek thinkers. They would have had such an affection for the transcendent God that the idea of a brutalized God, there was no way that would fit in their thinking. God was altogether other than them. And we do believe in a transcendent God, but we also believe in a God who has come to us. And so that distance, that would have been perhaps the wise ones. The scribe, this is a word that is not found in Greek literature. This is probably particular to the Jewish people of that day, a particular reference to the student of the law. So he's saying, here are the Greeks, the thinkers, the wise ones. And then the scribes, those students of the law, distinction. Where is the Greek philosopher? Where is the trained rabbi, student of the law? And where's the debater of this age? In other words, just show me your best apologist, your finest ethicist, who is the spokesman of this age. In other words, he is saying, I will carry this foolish message right out into the arena and engage them, for God is pleased to overcome the foolishness of the word of the world through the word of the cross. Verse 21, for since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. Phillips translates that word folly as nonsense. Through the nonsense of what we preach. This message, he is saying, is profoundly preposterous to the natural mind. To the perishing, this is foolishness. I think it's worth noting, I think it's particularly sweet, verse 21. Paul here highlights the free, spontaneous, unforced, sovereign activity of God. I love to consider this. Why does God save people as He does? Why has God chosen to save people as He does? Well, verse 21 tells us. Because it pleases Him. Because this just suits me to do it this way. I mean, it begins, and I think ends, with a God who is supreme in such a way that He does all that He pleases. It has pleased God through the foolishness, the nonsense, the folly of what we preach, to save those who believe. Now, let's just step back and say, that is clearly how the Corinthians saw this upstart religion. It's foolish. It really is foolish. And it is, throughout history and even in our day, seen very much the same way. The message of the cross is still foolishness to those who are perishing. It is still nonsensical. And it might be helpful for us as people who are banking a lot on this message. We're banking our eternal future on this message. We're banking our whole purpose in life on this message. It might be good for us just to pause and acknowledge that this is an extraordinary thing we believe, both in content and in motive. You know, when you lay out to a pure secularist the hope of the gospel, you know what we're asking them to believe? We're asking them to believe that there is a God who exists uncreated, who always existed outside of time. And they will say, well, do you worship one God? Yes, we worship one God. Well, who is Jesus? Well, He's God. Well, who is the Holy Spirit? He's God. Who's the Father? God. I thought you said you worship one God. Do worship one God. Exist in three persons. Can't explain it. Wish I could explain it to you. So if you're feeling pressure like we do to try to make this seem plausible to a natural mind, at some point you're going to have to deal with the Trinity. You're going to have to deal with the virgin birth. We believe this. And I'm telling you, the mind of natural man will always look at that. That is just so foolish. You're believing that Jesus was born without a natural father and retained all of His deity at that time. Yes, I believe that. And I believe, too, that He lived a blameless life and did not sin in thought, word, or deed for 33 natural years. Never. Blameless. I believe He calmed the oceans. I believe He healed lame people and blind people and caused dead people to raise from the dead like He did with Lazarus. Believe that. Yes, and then I believe He died as a substitute for you and for me. You know what else I believe? I believe He got up. In 3 days, He got up out of the grave. Come on now. That's folly! And you know what else I believe? A few days later, He floated up into heaven. And here's what else I believe. I believe He's going to float back down. Do you understand? That is folly to the natural man. And I would say that message will always run counter to now, by the way, what's the alternative? Natural selection? I'm going to say that's kind of foolish too. Let's just be fair. But He's saying, listen, the content of our message will always challenge the natural man. But Jesus did rise from the dead. That is an event that is cemented in history, and historians are still having to grapple with what happened in the days after Jesus' death. It happened. So not only is the content of our message foolish, the heart behind it is really preposterous. You consider this. Consider us. When we communed last week, I said to you, just look at us. Look at us. We are sinners by nature, and we are sinners by choice. We have seen God's law and transgressed it. We saw the line and we stepped across it. We have defied His law. We have lusted, we have stole, we have blasphemed. We have forsaken the fountain of living water and hewed out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. Cisterns like achievement, cisterns like wisdom, cisterns like sex and material gain. We have defied God and found for ourselves alternative deities. And we, the people of God, though riddled with iniquity and awash in our own filth, God loved. Now, does that make sense to you? Does that make plausible sense to you? When we sang the biblical truth as we did a moment ago, He has loved us like He loved His own Son. Does that make sense to you? That God has provided a righteousness that we cannot produce, that God in the person of Christ became the perfect sacrifice, that He died a shameful substitutionary death, and that that death paid the price of our sin, and that He rose from the dead, and that He lives now, right now, seated at the right hand of God the Father as a perfect mediator, making intercession for us now. Makes sense to you that He would love you in that way? The cross says that all of our sin has been seen fully, yet we have been loved fully, and our sin has been atoned for fully. That is a preposterous thing if there is not a merciful God. That we are loved by God, and we are His, and He is ours, and we commune with Him, and we come boldly, and a fountain is opened to us where there are pleasures forevermore, and He has cleared the way to God so that we will enjoy Him forever and ever and ever. Now, I'll say to the world that looks preposterous, and in many ways it is preposterous, except there is a kind of love that you and I cannot understand that has redeemed us. Does that make sense to you? It kind of is folly in a way. My friend Steve Bethel, he'll say sometimes when he's testifying of God's kindness to him, all the ways that God has been good to us, sometimes he'll just say, it's just silly. It's right in it. Just seems silly that He would be this good to me. To the perishing man it remains foolishness. But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God and it is the wisdom of God. So if we leave Corinth and come to Knoxville and consider the very message that is necessary to save us all, irrespective of background, irrespective of training, irrespective of heritage, irrespective of ethnicity or education, it is precisely the same message for the wise man and for the simpleton. For the UT professor who is brilliant, we would say the gospel carries good news for that man or woman. But for the very simple man, the very common, this message is so simple. Do you understand a child can get that? A child can understand the simplicity of this message. Children, if you can understand the nature of God as pure and holy and without sin, and you can see your own sin, and you can understand consequence, and you can understand substitution, all the simplest things, if you can understand what it means to turn and to embrace, the simplest themes of the gospel can be received by common people like us. It is precisely the same good news. And what we say about intellect, we could say about any other area, morality. There is not a prostitute track to redemption and a homeschool mom track to redemption. They come in the same way. They come in the same way through the message of the cross. We all come in low. And I will say that will always offend the ego of man. That will always offend our ego. It will always feel like foolishness to us. The truth is, the gospel offers very little to those who see themselves as powerful and wise. Jesus taught us that the blessed ones are the ones who are poor in spirit, those who mourn, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, those who see so clearly their need, their lack of wisdom. If we're ever to personally appropriate this message of folly, the message of the cross, the gain of the gospel, then we're going to have to make at least those two humbling admissions. That neither my strength nor my wisdom can fix my problem. I've got to embrace this simple message of the cross. So as we come like everybody else who's come to Jesus throughout history. We come broke. As Augustus Toplady said, with nothing in our hands, we cast our deadly doing down. We throw it down. That will never, listen, our wisdom will never save us. Our power will never save us. To those who are perishing, this message is foolish. But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. And it is the wisdom of God. So to the well-behaved, shepherded, polite, charming little girl, I would say she needs the same grace, the same faith, the same repentance as the most cruel man or woman. And that is the message of the gospel. It has a way of sort of leveling things, doesn't it? It puts us all on the same ground. Listen, Jews or Greeks, to those being called, Jews or Greeks, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Look at verse 22. For the Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and folly to the Gentiles. But to those who are called, there's a rich doctrinal theme there, who are called by grace. To those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. Those of Jewish background and those of Greek background both overcame obstacles, faced obstacles, but they were different obstacles. To the Jews, this message presents a stumbling block. It is a complete scandal. So actual word, scandalon there. It is a stumbling block. It's something I trip over. Why? Because what we read in Galatians 3 at the beginning of the service today, they knew, any informed Jew knows, curses anyone who hangs on a tree. And so now you're standing up and telling me my whole hope is based on one who hung on a tree. Now I'm sorry, I stumble over that. I stumble over that. Look, that's a scandal unto me. That's difficult for me to embrace. The Jews, the Bible says, demanded a sign. Their expectations of a Messiah were completely different than what was provided for them. They were saying, look, come and display your power. Show us something. Do something big. He did something big, not what they were expecting. Do something big. Overthrow our oppressors. They were looking for a miracle working deliverer, but they had nothing to do with a crucified Messiah. They didn't know what to do with that. To the proud Greeks, those intellectual heavyweights, they would look at this little band of Christians who were preaching the crucified Christ. And they're saying, that's your plan? I'm sorry, that's foolish to me. That is folly to me. Yet right in the middle of that environment, here we see little Paul stand up and say, but we preach Christ crucified. Paul will stand in this assembly of Jewish traditionalists and proud Greeks, the speculative philosophers, stand up and preach the simple message of the cross. And to the called ones, those who are called, irrespective of ethnicity, both Jews and Greeks, Jesus is the power of God and the wisdom of God. So if you are here and you're only marginally acquainted with Christianity, can I tell you, it is right here on this point. This is, if I can use the word, the crux of everything we believe and teach. We believe that all men are sinners by nature and by choice. We believe that God had a law and we broke it. And because God is holy, it is not in His nature to overlook any sin, including mine. So if I'm ever to be reconciled to the Father, something has to be done to answer my sin and yours. Something has to be done to clear away the penalty, the guilt of that sin. And that is the reason for the coming of Christ. Fully God, fully man. And He died on the cross to forgive all of our sins. That's it. He died to absorb in His blameless body the full measure of God's justified fury that should have fallen to me and should have fallen to you. And it was received. It was received. It was enough. So that when Jesus said it is finished, it really is finished. So that you and I, upon facing that glorious truth, can say, I abandon every other method I ever expected to use to reconcile myself to God. And I'm banking it all right there on that truth, right there, that Jesus died for my sins. Charles Haddon Spurgeon said, I love this, in fact, quoting 1 Corinthians chapter 15. He said, toward the end of his life, all the theology I need as a dying man is that Christ died for my sins. Now, I told you you didn't have to take notes. You may want to write that down. That's the heart of the gospel. All the theology I need is that Christ died for my sins. And to the natural man, it's foolishness, but nothing sweeter than that to us. Nothing sweeter. Paul said plainly, we preach Christ. And then he gives this sort of encapsulatory statement there, verse 25, and we'll be done. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men. All of this that seems so implausible to the world and so difficult to explain to the world, the foolishness of God is wiser than men. And the weakness of God is stronger than men. I want us just to consider that last thought there. The weakness of God is stronger than men. Even that language, weakness of God, where do we see God in weakness? We might pause and say, even in the crucifixion, Jesus was immensely powerful. Jesus was no victim. You know this from John's writings. No man, Jesus said, takes my life from me. I lay it down of myself. So this is purely and entirely voluntary. Jesus was no victim. He was very, very clear on saying, listen, legions of angels could come. I mean, at any point I say, enough, enough. So he was never more in control than he was at Calvary. Clear on that point. But there is a way in which we look at the cross and we see the weakness of God. At the cross, do we see the weakness of God? We see Jesus' agony in the garden where the force of something unspeakably horrible fell with all of its weight and descended on the blameless Christ. Do we see our God in weakness there? I think we do. Or when we see Him led before the high priest Caiaphas or Pilate or Herod, as a lamb was silent before his shearers, do we see the weakness of God there? I think there is a sense in which we do see God in weakness there. We see Jesus en route to the place of crucifixion when the cumulative effect of spiritual grief and blood loss and fatigue and a sleepless night fell, and his strength was diminished, and he stumbled beneath the weight of the cross, and Simon was conscripted. Is this our God in weakness? When we hear Jesus in a dry and wispy appeal saying, "I am thirsty," do we see our God in weakness there? Or in the sad word of forsaking, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," "My God, why have you forsaken me?" Is it there that we see our God in weakness? I think there is a sense in which we do. It is. It is our God in weakness. But listen to Paul. The weakness of God is stronger than men. It's stronger. Just how strong is this weakness? If we can speak of the power of the cross, we must look to another word from the cross, not "I thirst," not "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," but the last words of the cross, the words of effect, the words of accomplishment, when he said, "Done, it is finished, tetelestai, paid in full." The power of the cross is seen in its effect. Just how strong is this weakness? It is strong enough to bring the dead to life. It is strong enough to crush the serpent's head. How strong is this weakness? It's strong enough to ransom a people from every nation. And it is strong enough to cancel the legal demands of the law, to take it out of the way, nailing it. It is strong enough to rip the veil, clear the way to God. It is strong enough to exhaust the wrath of God fully. It is strong enough to destroy the works of the devil. How strong is this weakness of God? It is strong enough to free those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong bondage. And it is strong enough to lift fully and finally every bit of condemnation that was ours. The weakness of God is stronger than man. And hear me, brothers and sisters. It is strong enough to save you. And hear me, those of you who are not my brothers and sisters. It is strong enough. His blood can make the foulest clean. For his blood availed for me. By that act of weakness, death is crushed to death. Life is mine to live. So what do we say to the church that broken? What on earth do you say to Corinth? You hold up the cross. And what do we say to broken people like us? We hold up the cross. Well, we have considered it, celebrated it today. Let us sing of it. I've asked if we could close out our time, Mark leading us by singing a song that was reflective of Cooper, William Cooper's hope. The one thing where he found refuge was the cross. We're going to sing it together. It's hymn number 301. I invite you to stand if you would. There's a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins. Let's sing that together, number 301.